Usually when we picture like the ultimate athletic showdown, we think of a gunslinger duel from an old Western.
Right, like two people just staring each other down.
Exactly, waiting for that split second twitch. I mean, in sports, we just assume the winner is simply the person with the fastest reflexes. You know, the one who can react to a flying object faster than the human brain should technically even allow.
Oh, we completely idolize that pure, raw reaction time. I mean, we look at a highlight reel of a spectacular, flailing, last-second miracle save, and we think that is the absolute pinnacle of athletic achievement.
But then you step into the world of ice hockey goaltending, and suddenly that gunslinger metaphor just totally falls apart. We are looking at a discipline that is honestly entirely misunderstood by most people watching the game.
Yeah, it really is.
Because what looks like superhuman reflexes is actually just a geometric illusion. So today, for this deep dive, we are tearing down that illusion to see the blue paint the way an elite goaltender does.
Which is going to be so much fun.
We are going to build a mental model of the goaltender position literally from the ice up, so that the next time you watch a game or, you know, step onto the ice yourself, or even coach a player, you aren't just watching the puck. You are actively reading the underlying math of the position.
And the core philosophy we have to start with, I mean, the absolute foundation of understanding this position, is that goaltending is not primarily about reflexes.
Right.
It is about geometry. It's about spatial awareness and positioning. It is about being in the exact right place at the exact right depth at the exact right angle so that making the save requires almost no reflex at all.
So it's basically pre-calculated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you see that desperate flailing windmill save on a highlight reel, you know, you are usually watching a goalie frantically recovering from a microscopic failure in their initial geometry.
Wow. So the spectacular save is really just a desperate recovery from a mistake.
Most of the time, yeah.
That completely changes how you watch the sport. So you've built this premise that everything is geometry. Let's start building that physical structure. Because before a goalie can slide or push or catch a puck traveling at 100 miles an hour, they have to know how to simply stand still.
The stationary foundation.
Right, the stance. If your stance is flawed before the puck is even shot, I mean, how does that cascade into a failure when the puck actually arrives?
Oh, it cascades catastrophically. The ready stance is the launch pad for every single kinetic movement a goalie makes. If the launch pad is tilted, the rocket goes entirely off course.
Makes sense.
So let's look at the biomechanics from the ice up. Your feet need to be slightly wider than shoulder width apart. But the critical non-negotiable detail is where your weight is distributed. Your weight must be locked onto the inside edges of the balls of your feet.
Wait, so why the balls of the feet specifically? Because, like, if I'm standing comfortably, my weight is usually just resting back on my heels.
Which is exactly why comfortable standing gets you scored on.
Wow, okay.
Think about the physics of a lateral push. If your weight drifts back onto your heels, your kinetic energy is directed backward, away from the play. You literally cannot physically generate lateral power from a heel.
Because you have no leverage.
Right. The moment a pass goes sideways and you try to push off, if your weight is on your heels, your center of gravity just pulls you backward. You will physically fall onto your backside trying to slide across the crease.
That would be embarrassing.
It is. So the inside edges of the balls of your feet, they act like coiled springs.
Okay, so way forward, coiled on those inside edges. Then we have to get low, right? A goalie has to compress their body to take away the bottom of the net. But in the sources, I noticed a massive difference between how beginners get low and how professionals get low.
Oh, this is perhaps the most common biomechanical error in the entire sport. Beginners tend to bend at the waist. They hinge their upper body forward to get closer to the ice.
Like they're taking a bow.
Exactly. But the human head is incredibly heavy. So when you bend at the waist, your head drops forward, your shoulders push past your knees, and your entire center of gravity is completely compromised.
Because when the shot actually comes and you have to drop down to make a save, all that forward momentum just continues pulling you down.
You literally fall through your own save. Your face hits the ice, your balance is shattered, and you have absolutely zero ability to recover for a rebound.
So how do you fix it?
To get low correctly, you must bend entirely with your knees. You keep your chest up, your shoulders back, and your spine reasonably straight.
So you're lowering your center of gravity like an elevator going down a shaft, not like a drawbridge falling forward.
The elevator, not the drawbridge. I love that analogy. That is exactly right.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Now let's talk about the hands, because if I'm watching a youth hockey game, I constantly see young goalies resting their glove and blocker on their thighs or like holding them tight against their ribs.
Yeah, and it feels comfortable to rest your arms, but geometrically, it's a disaster.
Why is that?
Your hands must be extended out in front of your torso, pushed out far enough that they are clearly visible in your own peripheral vision while you're looking straight ahead at the puck.
Right, because this is a game of fractions of a second. If my glove is pulled back tight against my hip and a shot is fired to my left side, my glove first has to travel forward to get into the trajectory of the puck and then travel sideways to catch it.
And that two-part movement takes time you just don't have.
Exactly.
Precisely. If your hands are already extended out in front of you, they are already intersecting the geometric flight path of the puck. You don't have to reach out. You just have to rotate your wrist or make a tiny micro adjustment laterally. You are essentially building a forward wall.
It's like having your shield already raised and locked into position instead of trying to pull it off your back while the arrow is already in the air.
That's a great way to look at it.
Now let's look at the stick, because this is where the rule book actually dictates human biomechanics in a really fascinating way. The blade of the stick is flat on the ice, angled slightly forward to deflect pucks into the corners rather than, you know, ramping them up into your teeth.
Right, which you definitely want to avoid.
Definitely. But it's the paddle-like, the thick part of the stick, that dictates your entire body posture.
Yes, this is a brilliant intersection of equipment rules and physical geometry. The paddle bridges the gap between the ice and your grip. Its length dictates exactly how high your blocker hand sits when you are in your stance.
And this is where the rules fracture globally, which I found so interesting in the source material.
Oh, totally.
In the NHL, the absolute maximum allowed paddle length is 26 inches. But if you are playing internationally under IIHF rules, which covers Europe, the UK, and most international tournaments, the limit is 71 centimeters, which translates to roughly 28 inches. That is a 2-inch difference.
And 2 inches doesn't sound like much until you apply it to a rigid stance. If your paddle is 2 inches longer, your arm is forced 2 inches higher.
I think of it like adjusting the seat height in a race car.
Yeah.
You don't just change the seat. You change your sight lines, your pedal reach, your steering wheel leverage, everything.
Exactly.
If that stick paddle is acting like a 2-inch crutch, pushing your arm up, your entire shoulder elevates. And when your arm is pushed higher and further away from your rib cage, you expose a massive vulnerability.
You open up the six hole.
The six hole?
Yeah, the negative space between your blocker arm and your torso. Shooters are actively trained to look for daylight under the armpit. The moment a goalie uses a paddle that is too long for their height, they are artificially propping their arm up and exposing that gap.
So they're just giving away free net.
Basically, yeah. If a goalie's stance feels structurally flawed, the very first thing a coach should do is measure the paddle. Do not rebuild the player's biomechanics to accommodate the wrong piece of wood.
That is such a good tip. Okay, so we have this stance dialed in. Weight on the inside balls of the feet, knees bent like an elevator, chest proud, hands visible in the periphery, and a legally optimized paddle.
Perfect.
The body is a coiled spring and the head is perfectly still. Because ultimately, the eyes are the primary instrument of a goaltender. And the entire physical structure just exists to keep that camera perfectly steady.
Exactly right.
But now we take this perfect structure and we have to place it on the ice. We face the absolute fundamental mathematical decision of the position, which is depth.
Depth. It is the distance between the goal line and where the goalie establishes their stance. And it is the most vital, constant negotiation a goalie makes.
Because it's always changing.
Every single time the puck enters the defensive zone, you are making an economic calculation about depth.
And the core tension of that calculation is the trade-off between what we call the front door and the back door. I really want to break this down deeply for you listening. Because intuitively, if a guy is winding up to shoot, you just want to charge at him, get huge, and block out the sun. Right.
Right.
Why is that not always the right answer?
Because challenging the shooter taking aggressive depth out towards the front door costs you heavily in other areas. Let's look at the front door first. The front door is the puck carrier. The closer you get to them, the more of the physical net your body obscures from their perspective.
So you're cutting down the angle.
Exactly. But that aggressive depth comes with three distinct severe costs.
I can guess the first one is time.
Yes, reaction time. The further out you are, the less physical distance the puck has to travel to hit you. A puck traveling 90 miles an hour covers 40 feet in roughly 3/10 of a second.
Wow.
If you challenge out another 5 feet, you are shaving vital milliseconds off your visual processing time.
Okay, so you trade size for time. What is the second cost?
Lateral coverage, and this is where the back door comes in. If you are standing out past the top of your crease to challenge a shooter on the left wing, you have opened up a massive expanse of empty ice behind you on the right side of the net.
Oh, I see.
If that shooter decides not to shoot and instead fires a pass across the ice to a teammate waiting at the back door, you are completely stranded. You now have to travel an immense diagonal distance to get back to the far post.
So depth steals your ability to cover the pass.
Yeah.
And the third cost.
Spatial awareness. The crease is painted blue for a reason. It is your map. The further you wander out into the white ice, the harder it becomes to intuitively know exactly where your posts are behind you.
You just get lost in the white.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Goalies who challenge too far often find themselves drifting slightly off center, simply because they've lost their spatial anchors.
This completely frames the mental chess match of a rush. Like, if a lone attacker is coming down the wing and there are no passing options, no one at the back door, then you take the depth.
You challenge aggressively.
Right. You make yourself massive because there's no penalty for giving up the back door. But if it's a 2-on-1 rush,
then you must retreat. You sacrifice your depth on the front door to maintain your lateral connection to the back door. You stay deeper in the crease.
That's all a calculation.
It is. Being slightly less aggressive on a shot that you can clearly see is a calculated risk. But being perfectly positioned for a shot that never comes while a pass slips across to an empty net is a systemic failure.
So it's a sliding scale based on the threat of a pass. But there's a specific scenario that creates a massive tactical debate among elite goalie coaches.
Oh, the screens.
Yes. What happens when there is a point shot, a shot from far out by a defenseman, but there's a screen in front of you, like a player standing right in your sightline? Do you challenge the screen or do you retreat?
This is one of the most fascinating philosophical divides in the position. There are two entirely opposing schools of thought, and both have profound geometric arguments. The first school argues that when you are screened, you must drop deeper into your net. Give up the depth.
Which logically makes sense, based on what we just discussed about time.
Mm.
If you can't see the puck leaving the stick because a massive forward is standing in front of you, you drop deep to buy yourself an extra fraction of a second to pick up the puck's flight path once it passes the screen.
Exactly. You are buying visual processing time.
Right.
However, the opposing school of thought, and this is heavily emphasized in many modern development manuals, argues that retreating from a screen is a fundamental error. They argue that you must maintain a tight, aggressive gap standing right up against the player screening you.
But then you have even less time to react.
True, but you are changing the physics of the play. If you stand right up against the screen, you are eliminating the physical space between that player and yourself. When a shot comes through a crowd, the biggest danger isn't the straight shot, it's the deflection.
Ah, the tip.
Yes. If you give up depth, you leave a massive pocket of open air where the puck can change direction wildly. If you stay tight to the screen, the puck has no room to change trajectory after it passes them. Furthermore, taking that space away prevents opposing players from getting their sticks free to tip the puck in the first place.
So it's a choice between maximizing your visual sighting time by dropping deep or minimizing the physical deflection space by staying aggressive. It really highlights how every single movement is a compromise.
It absolutely is.
Now, let's synthesize this positional foundation. The gold standard for teaching this, popularized by the legendary goalie coach Mitch Korn, is a three-word formula: out, square, set. Let's unpack the geometry of those three words.
Step one is out. This is the depth calculation we just established. Finding the exact right distance from the goal line based on the threat level of the pass versus the shot.
Okay, got it.
Step two is square. This means your physical torso, your shoulders, chest, and hips are facing perfectly perpendicular to the puck. But more importantly, it means your center of mass is perfectly aligned on an imaginary string drawn from the puck directly to the absolute center of the goal line.
Wait, not the center of the net, but the center of the goal line between the posts. Because if you center yourself on the puck in the middle of the ice, but the puck is on the wing, your angle is completely broken.
Correct. You have to be centered on the net itself relative to the puck. And then we have step three set. This demands that at the exact microsecond the puck physically leaves the shooter's stick, the goaltender must be completely stationary. Feet planted, kinetic energy coiled, perfectly still.
Okay, I want to push back hard on this third step.
Go for it.
Because if I watch a modern NHL game, it is absolute hyperspeed chaos. The puck is zipped back and forth across the slot. Guys are shooting off balance. One-timers are flying everywhere. Goalies are constantly making saves while they're sliding, gliding, or mid-shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
Is the idea of being perfectly set actually an outdated textbook concept that just doesn't survive contact with modern, hyper-fast hockey?
It is a phenomenal question, and it's heavily debated in coaching circles. The reality of modern hockey is that you will rarely be perfectly out, square, and set on a broken play.
Right.
But the physics behind why set matters haven't changed, even if the game is faster. If you are tracking a pass laterally across the ice and the shooter fires the puck back against the grain, meaning they shoot it back toward the direction you just came from, if your feet are still gliding laterally, you are physically doomed.
Because your body weight is already committed to moving in one direction.
Yeah, exactly. You have absolutely no anchor. You cannot push off an edge if that edge is currently sliding across the ice. You are caught in a kinetic drift. The reason elite coaches still preach set is that they teach goalies to prioritize it over depth.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. If a pass is incredibly fast, you don't try to get all the way out to perfect depth if it means you'll still be moving when the shot is taken. You take a shallower route, you stay deeper in the net so that you have time to stop your feet and plant your edges before the release.
Set, then shoot. I love that framing. You sacrifice depth to buy stability. If we distill this entire first concept down to its core for everyone listening, the absolute golden rule here that your geometry dictates your success before the puck is even in flight. You negotiate your depth, you find your squareness to the center of the goal line, and you anchor your kinetic energy so you are ready to explode.
And that transition to exploding to actual movement is where the position becomes entirely unique. Because you've built this perfect coiled geometric stance, right? But the moment the puck is passed, that perfect stance is threatened. How do you move across the ice without breaking the geometry?
Right, which brings us seamlessly into the physics of movement. Goalies are wearing these massive 11-inch wide pads. They have a completely different center of gravity. They essentially never take a normal forward skating stride while the play is live.
Never.
The vocabulary of how they navigate the crease is a completely distinct physical discipline. Let's break down the core movements. First, the most fundamental, the shuffle.
The shuffle is designed for short lateral adjustments. A pass from the point to the half wall, or a player slowly carrying the puck across the top of the circles. To shuffle to your right, you maintain your low, coiled stance, you push firmly off the inside edge of your left skate, and you let your right skate glide sideways along the ice. You never turn your skates, they stay parallel.
And the massive geometric advantage here is that your chest remains perfectly square to the puck the entire time. You never turn your body away from the threat.
Exactly.
But there's a massive caveat with the shuffle. Why do coaches constantly preach that many small shuffles are vastly superior to one big shuffle?
Well, it comes back to structural vulnerability. When you take a massive, powerful shuffle step for a fraction of a second, your legs are spread incredibly wide. During that moment of maximum extension, you are exposing a massive five-hole gap between your legs.
Oh, right.
But more dangerously, when your legs are stretched that far apart, your hips lose all their leverage.
So you're just stranded mid-stride.
Yes. If the puck changes direction right at the moment of your maximum extension, you have no weight under your center of mass to initiate a change of direction. You are literally stuck until you bring your feet back together. Taking three rapid, short, crisp shuffles keeps your feet underneath your shoulders, keeping your five-hole protected, and your edges ready to redirect your momentum instantly.
Okay, so the shuffle is for short, safe, square movements. But what happens when the puck is passed all the way across the ice, like a huge cross-ice one-timer, a shuffle is far too slow to cover that kind of immense distance.
When you need raw speed and distance, you abandon the shuffle and use the T-push. The mechanics here are completely different. If you need to move far to your right, you physically turn your right skate outward, pointing the toe toward your destination, creating a T-shape with your skates.
Oh, I see.
Then you push explosively off the inside edge of your left skate, transfer all your weight over your right leg, and glide toward your spot.
It covers ground incredibly fast, but geometrically it carries a massive risk.
A profound risk. The moment you open that lead skate and push, your hips and your chest naturally turn toward your destination. You are no longer square to the puck. For the duration of that glide, your physical blocking area is turned sideways to the shooter.
Which is terrifying.
It is. If they manage to shoot the puck while you are mid-T-push, they are looking at a much larger expanse of open net because your torso isn't wide to them.
So you only use a T-push when you have the luxury of time like when a pass is in the air or the puck is behind the net.
Yeah.
And you can afford to temporarily break your squareness to gain speed.
Exactly. It's a calculated gamble of speed versus squareness. Then you have C cuts, which are crucial for depth management. to retreat backward into your net while keeping your chest perfectly facing the play, you carve alternating C shapes into the ice with the front inside edges of your skates. It allows you to glide backward without ever taking your eyes off the threat.
And C cuts are the engine behind the concept of flow. I found this part of the source material fascinating. When an opposing team is rushing down the ice toward you, you never want to be planted completely flat-footed on the edge of your crease, just waiting for them to arrive.
Flow is all about kinetic rhythm. If you are completely static, your muscles have to go from 0 to 100 in a millisecond to react to a shot or a deke. That requires massive force and time. By maintaining a very slight backward drift, a slow flow using tiny C cuts as the rush approaches, your legs are already engaged. Your kinetic chain is active. It is physically much faster to redirect existing momentum than it is to overcome absolute inertia.
But if your flow is too fast, you back yourself entirely into your own net and give the shooter all the room in the world. It's an incredibly delicate balance.
It takes years to master.
Now, let's talk about the actual pathway a goalie takes when moving. This completely shifted my understanding of the crease.
Mm-hmm.
When a goalie moves from one side of the net to the other to follow the puck, they don't just shuffle in a straight line parallel to the goal line.
No, moving in a straight horizontal line is a massive geometric error. Elite goalies navigate using the Y theory, or what's called the shallow arc.
How does that work?
Imagine the puck starts at the top of the faceoff circle, right in the middle of the ice. You are out at the top of your crease, challenging. Now the player passes the puck wide down into the corner.
Instinctively, I would just shuffle straight sideways to stay lined up with it.
But if you shuffle straight sideways, you remain at the top edge of your crease, very far from your net, while the puck is now at a sharp angle. As the puck moves toward the sideboards and down toward the goal line, the geometric angle to the net naturally closes itself. The net effectively shrinks from the puck's perspective.
Oh, wow.
You don't actually need extreme depth to cut off the angle anymore.
So by staying far out, you are taking away an angle that doesn't even exist while stranding yourself miles away from your posts.
Exactly. So instead of a straight line, you move on a curved arc back toward the post. You start out high in the middle, and as the puck moves wide, you retreat diagonally backward, ending up with your skate locked perfectly against the goalpost. This curving path completely eliminates the gap between your body and the pipe, sealing off the low short side, which coaches universally call the cheapest, most avoidable goal in hockey.
But this brings up a wild logistical reality. The goalie is tracking a puck, moving at blistering speeds. They are shuffling, they are T-pushing, they are carving backward on an invisible arc. But their eyes are glued entirely forward. They can never, ever turn their head around to look at the net behind them.
Never.
So how on earth do they not get completely lost in the white ice? How do they know exactly where their posts are?
It requires building an intense sensory map of the crease environment. A goalie navigates the ice almost entirely by tactile and peripheral feel. When you see a goalie reach their glove back to tap the metal post behind them or bang their stick against the pipe, that is not a nervous second or a superstition.
It's a navigational ping, like they're zeroing their internal GPS.
Precisely. They are establishing a physical anchor. They also feel the ice itself. They can feel the texture difference when their skate blade crosses the painted blue line of the crease. They feel the physical ruts they have carved into the ice over the course of the period. And visually, they rely heavily on the depth marks, the small red hashes painted just inside the blue paint of the crease.
But this is where the nuance of the rulebook crashes into the physical reality of playing the game again, because those painted visual anchors are not universally guaranteed.
Right. In the NHL, the rules strictly mandate these specific 5-inch hash marks in the crease paint to give goalies a peripheral gauge of how far out they are. But if a goaltender travels to play internationally or plays in a domestic league operating under IIHF rules, like all levels of hockey in the UK, for instance, the rulebook does not strictly mandate those specific NHL-style depth marks.
So a goalie might step onto the ice for an international tournament, look down, and their entire peripheral measuring system is just gone. The ice is totally blank.
Which is why elite preparation dictates that a goaltender must explicitly check the crease markings during warm-ups. You cannot assume your visual anchors will be there. You have to adjust your internal map before the puck drops.
That is the exact kind of microscopic detail that separates a good deep dive from a great one. The physical ice might literally be painted differently depending on which rulebook governs the arena. Let's move to the ultimate integration of the goalie and the net.
The post play.
Exactly. The puck goes deep into the corner or behind the goal line. You have tracked back on your arc. You now have to physically seal the post to prevent a wraparound or a bank shot. This introduces us to two massive tactical acronyms, VH and RVH. Let's start with VH.
VH stands for vertical horizontal. It was the dominant post-play technique of the 2000s, often called the split butterfly. When the puck is deep on your left side, your left leg, the one against the post, remains straight up, vertical. Your left pad forms a tall wall against the metal pipe. Your right leg, the far leg, drops horizontally along the ice, flaring out to cover the pass across the crease.
So it builds a very tall wall right on the post. But over the last decade, the sport has experienced a massive paradigm shift away from VH toward RVH, reverse VH. How does the biomechanics of that work?
It reverses the responsibilities of the legs. In RVH, your post leg, the left leg in this scenario, drops horizontally flat onto the ice. Your skate blade connects with the base of the post, and your pad seals the entire bottom edge of the ice.
Okay, so the inside leg is down.
Right. Your right leg, the back leg, away from the post, stays vertical. You physically lean your upper body weight over your horizontal knee, crushing your shoulder into the post to seal the gap.
It creates an absolutely impenetrable seal right along the ice, which kills the wraparound attempt entirely.
Completely kills it.
But to execute RVH correctly, there is one critical, non-negotiable mechanic that is constantly missed by developing goalies. If you miss this, the technique completely implodes. It's all about the back foot.
The anchor. When you drop into the RVH, your back leg, the vertical one, cannot simply be resting gently on the ice. The inside edge of that skate blade must be violently dug into the ice at a hard 45-degree angle. It is a load-bearing anchor.
Why is that angle so vital?
Because of the physics of impact. When you are in RVH, your body is leaning heavily against the post. If a player drives hard to the net and shoots the puck into your chest or literally crashes into your body, all of that kinetic force pushes you backward.
Right.
If your back skate is flat or not biting into the ice, you have no resistance. That shot will physically drive your entire body backward, and you will slide smoothly entirely into your own net, carrying the puck with you. The 45-degree anchor edge is the break that stops you from being pushed over the goal line.
You have to literally bolt yourself to the ice. Now, RVH is incredibly popular because it seals the ice so well. But it has massive tactical flaws, which is why it's a constant source of debate.
It has severe vulnerabilities. First and foremost, geometrically, by dropping your near knee to the ice and leaning over, you naturally drop your near shoulder. This exposes a massive triangle of open net in the high short side corner right over your shoulder. Elite NHL shooters know this. They will carry the puck low, force the goalie to commit into the RVH, and then roof the puck right over that dropped shoulder into the top corner.
You fix one hole, you open another.
Exactly. The second major flaw is mobility. Once you are locked into RVH, you are physically tethered to the post. If the puck carrier suddenly passes the puck into the high slot, pushing off from an RVH position to slide diagonally out to the top of the crease is biomechanically awkward and slow, you can easily get trapped on the post while the play moves away from you.
I was looking into the history of this, and it's fascinating. RVH was actually pioneered in Sweden around 2010 by coaches who were specifically trying to solve the mobility issues of the old VH style. It is wild how a technique can conquer the global game, but still require this constant tactical management.
It really is.
The traditional North American coaching approach is highly conservative. Get onto the post late and get off it as early as possible. Don't get stuck. But the Swedish approach uses strict mathematical trigger lines on the ice to dictate exactly when a goalie drops into it.
But regardless of which philosophy a coach adopts, the universal truth is that dropping into RVH purely out of habit without actively reading the specific threat of the play is a catastrophic error. It makes you a passive blocker rather than an active athlete.
Right.
And we cannot discuss these complex extreme movements, the RVH, the full butterfly, the explosive T pushes, without addressing the profound physical toll they take on the human body.
Because goaltending demands that the human hip do things it was absolutely not evolutionarily designed to do.
The torque placed on a goaltender's hips and groin is immense. When you drop into a wide butterfly, your femurs are internally rotating while your knees are violently hitting the ice, all while your core is trying to keep your torso upright. A recent sports medicine study which analyzed NHL goaltender injuries found that proximal adductor injuries, which are severe groin strains, were by far the largest single injury category, causing the most missed days of the season.
The forces at the absolute end of the joint's range of motion are just punishing. So how do they mitigate that?
By entirely abandoning outdated warm-up philosophies. The mandate now is brutally clear. You can never go into the net cold. And static stretching, sitting on the ice and touching your toes for 30 seconds, is actually detrimental right before explosive movement.
Wow, really?
Yeah, the evidence strongly mandates dynamic warm-ups. Active movement-based stretching that gets the blood flowing, increases the core temperature, and forces the neuromuscular system to fire properly before you ever face a live shot.
So if we distill the physics of movement down to its essence for our listeners, you shuffle to maintain squareness, you T-push to sacrifice squareness for speed, you carve the shallow arc to mathematically shrink the net, and you anchor your RVH to survive impact.
That is the perfect summary.
It is a highly engineered system of navigation. But eventually, all the movement stops. The play culminates. The puck is fired. We arrived at the actual interception of the object.
The mechanics of the save. And here we encounter a statement in modern coaching philosophy that sounds almost controversial to a casual fan. Saves are chosen, not reacted to.
That immediately attacks the gunslinger myth again. What does it mean to choose a save rather than react?
It means that you aren't just flailing your limbs at a visual blur and hoping for a collision. You are calculating the trajectory, speed, and angle of the puck, and you are deliberately selecting the specific biomechanical tool, the blocker, the glove, the butterfly, designed to intercept that specific math. But to make that choice, your visual tracking data has to be flawless.
Object interception relies entirely on how the brain processes the visual data of a small black disc moving at terrifying speeds against a backdrop of white ice, whiteboards, and chaotic player movement.
The visual science of tracking is incredibly complex. The human eye tracks high-speed objects using two distinct functions. Smooth pursuit is when your eyes lock onto the puck and follow its continuous path smoothly. But because the puck moves too fast for smooth pursuit alone, your brain also uses Saccade's rapid, jerky eye movements that dart ahead to predict where the puck will be, snapping back and forth to update the trajectory.
But the physical technique taught to elite goalies to maximize this visual tracking is fascinating. You don't just move your eyes inside their sockets, you have to physically track the puck with your head.
Head tracking is paramount. Your visual acuity, your ability to see sharp detail, is highest in the absolute center of your field of vision, the fovea. If you keep your head still and only move your eyes to track a puck into your peripheral vision, you lose detail, you lose depth perception, and you drastically increase the chance of the puck slipping through a hole. By physically turning your head to follow the puck's path, you keep the object locked in the high-resolution center of your vision.
There's an incredible analogy for this used in the sources by goalie coach John Caratu. He calls it the cone of shame.
It perfectly encapsulates the required mental state. Imagine a dog wearing a large plastic veterinary cone around its neck. When a goalie is tracking a shot, they need to adopt that exact tunnel vision. Nothing outside the direct physical path of the puck should exist in their reality.
And crucially, that cone of focus cannot break at the moment of impact.
This is where so many saves fall apart. A goalie will track the puck perfectly, but right as it hits their chest or their pad, they subconsciously brace for impact. They snap their head back or they flail their arms in a massive, explosive movement. The moment you snap your head up, your eyes come off the puck and you have absolutely no idea where the rebound just went. You must maintain a quiet head and quiet hands. You watch the puck physically impact your gear.
Track it all the way into the fabric of your jersey.
Oh.
Okay, so we've tracked the data perfectly. Now we have to execute the chosen save. And this requires a deep, honest conversation about the most famous move in goaltending, the butterfly.
Ah, yeah.
Dropping to both knees, flaring the pads out wide, completely sealing the bottom foot of the entire net. It is the defining style of modern hockey because mathematically, most goals are scored along the ice.
But elite development coaches issue a massive blinking warning light about the butterfly. They stress that the butterfly is a highly effective tool, but it is not a religion. It is not the default answer to every single problem.
But why not? Like, if a goalie just drops into the butterfly the second the puck is shot, they instantly cover the most dangerous part of the net. Why is that bad?
Because it is a panic response, not a calculated choice. If you drop early, simply as a reflex to the stick hitting the puck, you suffer three massive tactical failures. First, the moment your knees hit the ice, you drastically lower your shoulders. You instantly surrender the entire top half of the net to an accurate shooter. Second, your mobility evaporates. Once you are down, if the shooter faked the shot and passes instead, you cannot easily push across the crease to recover.
And the third reason, which is absolutely vital for anyone listening who coaches youth hockey, is the physical reality of human growth.
Yes, a 6'4", 30-year-old NHL professional can drop into a butterfly and their shoulders still physically reach the crossbar. They cover an immense amount of net while on their knees. A 12-year-old goaltender who is 5 feet tall dropping into a butterfly leaves an absolute ocean of empty air above their head. If a youth coach allows young goalies to just flop to their knees on every single play, they are setting them up for catastrophic failure as they get older and face shooters who can elevate the puck.
Dropping by default removes your agency. You stop reading the play. The protocol should be stay on your feet until the specific trajectory of the puck dictates that the butterfly is the exact required tool. Because you have an entire arsenal. You have the half butterfly, where only one leg drops. You have the blocker deflection. You have the chest smother. And you have the glove catch, which is the absolute ultimate victory because it freezes play instantly.
And you even have aggressive tools like the poke check thrusting your stick forward to knock the puck off the attacker's blade. But coaches warn that a poke check is a massive, high-risk commitment. When you lunge forward, your center of gravity completely shifts over your toes. If you miss the puck, you are entirely off balance face first with a wide open net behind you.
Every save selection is a risk-reward calculation, but making the initial save is genuinely only half the battle. This brings us to what I think is the most underappreciated hidden art in all of sports rebound control.
It is the defining metric of an elite goaltender. If a goalie makes a spectacular, acrobatic save on a 40-foot slap shot, but the puck bounces violently off their pad right back into the center of the slot where an opposing forward is standing, that wasn't a good save. You have just taken a low-danger scoring chance and physically converted it into a high-danger point-blank scoring chance.
You essentially pass the puck to the enemy. To fix this, legendary goalie coach Joe Britannia built a strict 4-step priority framework for managing rebounds. Let's walk through it for everyone.
Priority number one is the ideal outcome. Prevent the rebound entirely. Swallow the puck. Catch it in the glove, trap it in the logo of the chest protector, or smother it against the ice.
Okay, if you can't prevent it.
Priority number two, cover or clear the loose puck immediately before an opponent can arrive. Priority number three, if the shot is too hard to catch, direct the rebound deliberately into a safe, non-threatening area of the ice. And priority number four, recover your stance and your depth instantly to prepare for the secondary shot.
Prevent, cover, direct, recover. That is so memorable. Let's focus on prevention first. How do you stop a piece of vulcanized rubber traveling 90 miles an hour from ricocheting off you like a pinball?
It requires a deep understanding of impact physics. Goalies use what is called the soft stick or soft body technique. If a hard shot hits a rigid, tightly gripped stick blade, the kinetic energy has nowhere to go, so it violently repels the puck outward. It acts like a trampoline. But if you relax your grip just a fraction of an inch right at the moment of impact, the blade of the stick gives slightly.
It acts like a shock absorber.
Exactly. It absorbs the kinetic energy of the puck, killing its momentum, causing it to drop dead directly at your skates where you can easily cover it. The exact same physics apply to the chest protector. If you flex your core and brace stiffly for a chest shot, the puck bounces off you. If you exhale slightly and relax your torso, you absorb the blow and trap the puck.
But sometimes a shot is just too hard, or it's aimed precisely at your blocker pad, which is essentially a solid board of high-density foam. You can't absorb that. You have to execute priority three direct it.
This is where geometry returns. You manipulate the angles of your blocking surfaces. If a heavy shot comes to your blocker, you do not hold the blocker flat, facing straight up the ice. You subtly rotate your wrist to angle the flat face of the blocker toward the corner boards. You act as a deliberate ramp.
I see.
The puck hits you and ricochets violently wide of the net, preferably below the goal line, turning a lethal shot into a harmless 50-50 battle in the corner.
But knowing where to direct that rebound reveals the most mind-bending aspect of this entire process. The actual calculation for a rebound doesn't happen when the puck hits you. It happens before the puck is even shot.
This is the invisible genius of the position. Rebound control is 50% physical technique and 50% cognitive mapping. While the opposing team is passing the puck around the zone, your brain must constantly scan the ice, looking away from the puck carrier for fractions of a second to map out the exact locations of the other offensive players.
And you can't just vaguely know someone is over there. You have to log highly specific data.
You have to process, like, there's a left-handed shot hovering near the back post on my right side. You log that data. Why? because if the puck carrier shoots and you have to direct a rebound, you mathematically know that you absolutely cannot angle your right pad to kick the puck to that side of the ice. You would be feeding a perfect one-timer to a left-handed blade.
Wow. So by mapping the threats before the shot, you'd eliminate the dangerous rebound vectors in advance. If you are only staring at the puck with tunnel vision, you are directing rebounds blindly into the void. If we distill this down to the core concept, it is that a master goaltender doesn't just block the puck. They dictate exactly where the play goes next by absorbing energy or manipulating angles based on a pre-calculated map of the ice.
And that pre-calculated map is vital because up until now, we've discussed these mechanics as if the goalie is alone on the ice. But hockey is played in absolute visceral chaos. You aren't in a vacuum. You are dealing with traffic, obscured sight lines, breakaways, and the unpredictable actions of 9 other skaters.
Which means we must learn to manage the chaos. Let's start with the most common form of chaos, the scream. An opposing player legally parks themselves directly in front of the crease, completely eclipsing your view of the puck. It neutralizes your ability to track, to map, and to set your depth.
It is the most helpless feeling in the position. And tactically, there is a fierce coaching split on the physics of how to fight for that sight line.
The age-old debate. Do you look around the screens or do you look over it?
Exactly. One philosophy teaches that you must widen your stance, drop your center of gravity exceptionally low, and physically look around the screening player's hips or under their arms. You hunt for a visual window through the forest of legs.
But the obvious risk there is that if you are crunched down incredibly low looking through legs and the defenseman fired a high shot into the top corner, you are completely dead to rights. You can't explode upward fast enough.
Which is the core argument of the opposing philosophy. The lookover school argues that prioritizing sight over structure is a mistake. They teach that you should stand tall, maintain your maximum physical size and blocking area, and look over the shoulder of the screening player.
But then you are blind to a low shot releasing off the blade.
Yes. Both approaches carry massive inherent risks. But elite coaches universally agree on one fatal mistake you must avoid, regardless of whether you look over or around. You can never half see the puck.
What does that mean, half see?
It means trying to look past the left side of the player and the right side of the player simultaneously, swaying your head back and forth like a pendulum. If you do that, your head is moving exactly when the shot is released, breaking your tracking, and your weight is shifting unpredictably. You must pick one side, lock into that visual window, and completely commit your structure to it.
And beyond visual tactics, you have to use your voice. You have to scream "screen" to your defenseman. It is a direct, non-negotiable command for your teammate to physically cross-check or push that opposing player out of your sightline.
Because if they don't clear that player, you face an even deadlier threat than the blind shot, the tip, a deflection.
Right, the defenseman shoots from 60 feet away, but the guy screening you simply taps the puck with his stick blade on the way past, changing his trajectory 10 feet in front of your face.
Which completely defies the limits of human reaction time. If a puck changes direction that close to the net, no biological reflex can save you.
So how do you stop it?
Through disciplined patience. If you see an attacker parked in the goal mouth with their stick blade hovering over the ice, you must mentally process every single shot from the perimeter, not as a direct shot, but as a probable tip. The absolute worst thing you can do is react to the initial release by dropping violently into a butterfly.
Because if you drop early, you shrink your body, and a puck tipped upward will just sail harmlessly over your shoulder.
Exactly. The technique is to stay tall, hold your ground, and remain completely set. You become a rigid wall. If the puck is tipped low, your leg pads are already there. If it's tipped high, your chest is still occupying that airspace. You don't try to react to the deflection. You rely entirely on maximizing the statistical percentages of your physical blocking area.
It's about being a calculated, patient wall rather than a jumping, guessing acrobat. Now, let's pivot to a totally different flavor of chaos. The ice opens up. A turnover at the blue line. It's a breakaway, one-on-one. Just the goalie and the shooter skating in alone. The manual makes a brilliant observation here. The actual difficulty of a breakaway is not the speed of the player. It is the amount of time you have to think.
It is entirely a psychological battle of chicken. The tactical protocol is highly structured. As the player crosses the blue line, you must skate aggressively out beyond the top of the crease to meet them, eating up the front door depth and cutting off the visual net. But as they cross the face-off dots and close the distance, you must transition to backward Z cuts.
And the key here is matching their speed, right?
Precisely. If you retreat slower than they are skating, they blow past you. If you retreat faster than they are skating, you back yourself deep into the net, giving them the entire goal to shoot at. By perfectly matching their forward speed with your backward C cuts, the geometric angle between the puck and the post remains completely static and closed the entire way down the ice.
And maintaining that backward flow means your muscles are engaged, ready to fire laterally if they deke. The golden rule I always hear for breakaways is the last one to move wins. Never make the first move. Force the shooter to commit. But what should the goalie's eyes actually be looking at during this high-speed chess match?
This sparks another brilliant coaching split. The traditional, fundamental school of thought teaches that you must watch the puck, and only the puck. The logic is that a skilled forward will drop their shoulder, look up at the rafters, and swivel their hips, using their entire body as a theatrical tool designed specifically to fake you out. Only the puck is the truth.
That makes sense. But the opposing school argues that the puck is actually the easiest thing to fake with. A player can dangle the puck left and right with their wrists without ever shifting their actual body weight.
Exactly. So the opposing school teaches goalies to read the shooter's chest or the logo on their jersey. Because while hands can lie, a human being's center of gravity cannot. If a player intends to violently cut to the left, their chest and hips must physically commit in that direction first to generate the edge work.
So again, neither philosophy is inherently wrong, but you have to pick one and commit. If you try to watch the puck and the chest simultaneously, your brain short circuits. Now, what happens when that breakaway results in a desperate slash by a defenseman and the referee blows the whistle and awards a penalty shot? Suddenly, the chaos is highly formalized by the rulebook.
Penalty shots are fascinating because they impose severe legal constraints on the chaos. The core rule is that the shooter must keep the puck in continuous forward motion toward the goal line. They cannot stop and skate backward to reset. Furthermore, absolutely no rebounds are allowed. The moment the puck crosses the goal line, is saved, or stops forward momentum, the play is dead.
The only exception is if the puck hits the post, bounces off the goalie's back, and goes in. That counts as continuous motion. But there are specific moves that are heavily legislated.
Yes, the famous spinorama, where a player executes a full 360-degree spin with the puck to confuse the goalie, was banned because it momentarily stops the forward progress of the puck. However, the lacrosse-style move, where a player literally scoops the puck onto the blade of their stick and tries to throw it in, is perfectly legal, provided the stick blade never elevates above the physical height of the crossbar.
And what constraints are placed on the goalie? Like, what if the goalie tries to cheat and jump out to poke the puck away before the player even gets close?
If the goalie leaves the crease early to initiate contact, the rules escalate based on the league. In the NHL, it's a ladder of warnings. A first early departure results in a warning and a retake of the shot. A second violation adds a misconduct penalty. A third violation is a game misconduct, meaning the goalie is ejected and the cold backup goalie has to come off the bench to face the penalty shot.
But internationally, it's far more ruthless.
Oh, absolutely. If you are playing under IIHF rules or in the UK, there is no backup goalie sequence. If you commit a third early departure violation on a penalty shot, the referee simply points to center ice. It is an automatic awarded goal. You lose the mental battle so badly that the rules just award the point.
Speaking of ruthless rules and awarded goals, let's look at the empty net situation. It's late in the game, your team is down by a goal, and the coach signals for you to sprint to the bench so an extra attacker can jump on the ice. It is a 6-on-5. The manual is very clear on the protocol. Go hard, go early, and whatever you do not drop your stick in front of the net on your way out.
This exposes a brilliant, bizarre quirk in how different rule books handle intentional sabotage. If a goalie is skating to the bench and deliberately leaves their stick lying across the goal line, or intentionally piles up a mound of snow to physically stop a puck from sliding into the empty net, the penalties diverge wildly.
Because obviously, if the other team shoots from 200 feet away and hits your discarded stick, you've cheated them out of a goal.
Right. In the NHL and under IIHF rules, the timing of your body is what matters. If you have physically stepped off the ice onto the bench and the puck hits your discarded stick, it is an automatic awarded goal. However, if you are still physically skating on the ice when the puck hits your stick, it is merely assessed as a 2-minute minor penalty for interference.
But USA Hockey simplifies this drastically.
Under USA Hockey, they do not care where your body is. If you intentionally leave an object to guard the empty net and the puck hits it is an automatic awarded goal, period.
And Hockey Canada takes the most aggressive stance of all.
Hockey Canada dictates that if you are still on the ice and the puck hits your discarded stick, they don't award a goal and they don't call a minor penalty. They award a penalty shot on an empty net.
That is wild.
The disparity across borders is crazy. The absolute lesson is take your lumber with you when you leave.
Just carry your stick. Now, we've talked about opposing players and rules causing chaos, but let's look inward. What do goalies need from the other five skaters on their own team? How do your own teammates ruin your life?
The list is long, but it starts with screens. Number one, do not screen your own goaltender. It sounds elementary, but defensemen are trained to block shots. In their effort to get in front of a puck, they constantly backpedal directly into the goalie's lap, completely eclipsing the goalie's vision, only to accidentally deflect the puck into their own net. You must give your goalie a sightline.
They also have to manage the chaos after the initial save. We discussed the goalie directing the rebound into the corner, but what if the puck drops right in the crease?
That is the skater's responsibility. It is called the box out. The defenseman must establish physical inside body position on the opposing forward, putting themselves between the opponent and the puck, effectively boxing them out of the rebound zone.
And what about on a two-on-one rush? Two attackers, one defenseman, and the goalie. How is the labor divided?
The division of labor must be absolute and uncompromising. The defenseman's sole job is to take away the pass to the back door. The goalie's sole job is to take the front door shooter. If the defenseman tries to play the hero and lunges at the shooter, the pass goes across for an empty net. If the goalie panics and tries to cheat toward the pass, the shooter scores easily. Do not try to play both, or you will play neither.
And there is one more skater interaction we have to cover, and it happens before the game even starts. Warm-ups. The sources highlight a massive pet peeve that is actually a severe safety issue.
Skaters who lazily fire pucks at their own goalie's head during pregame warm-ups. It is incredibly dangerous, disrespectful, and completely counterproductive to warming up a goalie's eyes. But what makes this terrifying is how little protection the rulebook actually offers a goalie who takes a puck to the mask during a live game.
This truly blew my mind. If a goalie takes a 90-mile-an-hour slap shot directly to the fiberglass face mask, the referee doesn't just automatically blow the whistle to stop play.
Not in the NHL and not in USA Hockey. Under those rules, the referee must visually judge that the goalie is actively injured before stopping the play. But how is a referee supposed to diagnose a concussion or a shattered jaw through a painted fiberglass mask while the puck is still live? They often let the play continue while the goalie is severely concussed.
The international rules are slightly better, right?
The IIHF gives the referee the discretion to stop play immediately if the puck hits the mask, provided there is no immediate, imminent scoring chance for the other team. Hockey Canada goes the furthest, but only for youth. They mandate an absolute immediate stoppage of play if a puck hits the mask, but only for kids U13 and below.
The overarching point being, the cavalry might not come to stop the play. Your brain health is at risk. So defensemen, do not headhunt your goalie in practice. If we synthesize this chaos module, you survive the chaos by maintaining your structure. You fight for sight lines, you match speed on breakaways, you rely on absolute division of labor on rushes, and you never leave your stick in an empty net.
Which seamlessly brings us to our final and perhaps most complex frontier. We have mastered the physical geometry. We have survived the chaos. Now we must master the legal and mental environment. Because a truly elite goaltender doesn't just stop pucks. They manage the entire defensive zone like a general.
And a general cannot be silent. The manual has a fantastic quote, "Silence is a turnover."
Think about the physical orientation of the game. When the puck is dumped into the corner, all five skaters on your team turn their backs to the play to chase it down. The goalie is the only player on the ice facing forward, watching the entire play develop. You have a god's eye view.
If a defenseman is skating hard into the corner to retrieve a puck, staring at the glass, they are entirely blind to the 220-pound forechecker bearing down on their spine.
If the goalie is silent, that defenseman takes a brutal, dangerous hit and the puck is turned over. The goalie's voice is the defense's radar.
And there is a highly specific, standardized vocabulary for this radar. The principles are: early beats loud, and short beats descriptive. You don't yell, "Hey, buddy, there's a guy sneaking up behind you on your left." By the time you finish the sentence, he's concussed. What are the specific calls?
If an opposing player is closing in fast, you bark, "Man on!" That means get rid of the puck instantly, take the hit safely. If the defenseman has space to turn and skate, you yell, time! If you want them to pass the puck back against the natural flow of the play, you yell, reverse! If you want them to shoot it hard or on the glass, you yell, rim! And if the puck is slowly sliding toward the net and you intend to trap it for them, you yell, leave it!
But there is one call that is incredibly counterintuitive. The shot call.
Yes. When a goalie screams, shot. This is not a warning that a shot is coming. It is a tactical command to the defenseman. It means, I have perfect squareness and depth on the puck carrier. I am demanding that you abandon the shooter and completely cover the passing option.
Communication is vital. But eventually, the goalie has to physically interact with the puck outside of just making saves. Puck handling. And the golden rule here is so incredibly simple, yet so often violated. Never leave your net for a 50-50 puck.
The geometry of risk here is brutal. If a puck is slowly sliding down the ice, and it is a pure foot race between you and an opposing forechecker, if you lose that race by a single inch, you are stranded outside your crease, the net is completely empty, and you will be scored on. You only leave the crease to play the puck when you have absolute 100% guaranteed ownership of the race.
And even when you do win the race, the rulebook severely constrains where you are legally allowed to touch the puck. We have to talk about the most famous geometry painted on the ice, the trapezoid.
The trapezoid is the red-lined area painted directly behind the net. The NHL and IIHF implemented this rule specifically to stop elite puck-handling goalies like Martin Brodeur from acting as a third defenseman and instantly clearing every puck shot into the corner.
It artificially limits their influence.
Precisely. The rule dictates that a goaltender is only legally allowed to play the puck behind the goal line if the puck is physically inside that painted trapezoid. If the goalie plays the puck behind the goal line, but outside the trapezoid, say deep in the corner boards, it is an automatic 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game.
The sources make a really vital distinction here, though. The rule is entirely based on the location of the puck, not the location of the goalie's body. What happens if a player whips the puck hard around the glass? The goalie is standing outside the trapezoid, and the puck physically hits the goalie's leg.
If it simply hits you, there is no penalty. The geometry applies to your intent. You have to actively play the puck with your stick to be penalized.
Okay, so the trapezoid limits passing. But now we must descend into the absolute madness of freezing the puck. When a goalie catches or covers the puck with their glove to force a stoppage of play, this is where the rule books of the NHL, the IIHF, USA Hockey, and Hockey Canada just completely fracture into different realities.
It is the most legally complicated aspect of the position. Let's start with the universal baseline. You make a save, the puck drops dead in your crease, you freeze it, you get a whistle. But you only have 3 seconds to play the puck or freeze it before it becomes a delay of game penalty, unless you are actively being pressured by an opponent.
That makes sense. Keep the game moving. But what if the puck rebounds and comes to a stop 3 feet outside the blue paint of the crease?
This is where you must know exactly which league you are playing in. In the NHL and under IIHF rules, the crease is a strict legal boundary. A deliberate freeze of a puck outside the blue paint is a minor penalty for delay of game. The only legal exception is if the momentum of making a save physically carries your body outside the crease, then you are permitted to cover it.
But USA Hockey treats this entirely differently.
Wildly differently. USA Hockey grants goaltenders a massive privileged area that extends all the way out from the crease to the faceoff dots. Under USA Hockey rules, a goalie can sprint out and dive on a loose puck anywhere within that massive zone to freeze it, provided they are under pressure from an attacker. You don't need a single millimeter of your gear touching the blue paint.
And if you drive a few hours north into Canada?
Hockey Canada is draconian. Their interpretation explicitly states that once a goaltender's body leaves the crease, they will not be allowed to freeze the puck at all. If they dive on a puck outside the crease, it is a minor penalty, and the rulebook stresses that no warning will be issued.
I just want to underline how insane that is. The exact same physical action diving on a loose puck 3 feet outside the crease is perfectly legal and praised in Chicago. It's a minor penalty in Toronto, and it's highly contextual based on momentum in London.
And this legal chaos extends to how goalies manage the ice itself. What about when a goalie uses their stick to sweep a pile of snow in front of the goal line, trying to create friction to slow down a sliding puck?
Right, building a little snowbank.
In the NHL, IIHF, and USA Hockey, deliberately piling snow to prevent a goal is a standard 2-minute minor penalty. But in Hockey Canada, if you build a snowbank and it stops the puck, they can award a penalty shot.
The rulebook is a minefield. What about the physical protection of the goalie? Goaltender interference. when a 250-pound forward crashes the net.
The universal foundational rule is the blue paint belongs exclusively to the goaltender. If an attacking player initiates physical contact with you while you are inside the crease and the puck enters the net, the goal is immediately disallowed. Furthermore, if an attacker physically pushes your body backward into the net while you are holding the puck, it is no goal. Unless the physical contact was caused by your own defenseman shoving that attacker into you. If your own teammate causes the crash, the goal counts. It's your own team's fault. And goalies must remember they are not immune to the rule book. If you violently slash an opponent hacking at your glove, you will sit in the penalty box. And more importantly, in the modern game, if you dive, flop, or embellish contact trying to draw an interference penalty, you will be assessed a 2-minute minor for unsportsmanlike conduct.
The referees are heavily scrutinizing theatrical goalies now. Let's finish the legal section by talking about the gear mandated by these rules.
Two crucial pieces of safety equipment stand out. First, the helmet. A goalie might borrow a helmet that has an in-date certification sticker on the back, but the manual offers a chilling warning. A certification sticker is merely a clock. It is not a condition report.
Because it tells you nothing about the trauma that helmet has already endured.
Exactly. It doesn't tell you how many 90-mile-an-hour impacts the internal foam has already absorbed. Foam crushes to absorb energy, but it does not uncrush. A legally certified helmet might internally offer zero protection. The ultimate advice is buy your own mask, borrow everything else.
And the second piece of gear is hyper-specific to the UK and home countries, the neck laceration protector.
In the wake of tragic on-ice accidents, the UK rule is absolute and severe. A neck laceration protector is mandatory for all players of all ages, including fully grown adults in senior leagues. If a goalie steps onto the ice in the UK without one, there is no warning given. It is an immediate 10-minute misconduct penalty. USA Hockey exempts adults, but in the UK, the rule prioritizes catastrophic injury prevention above all else.
All right. We have mastered the physical geometry. We've dissected the legal labyrinth. Now we enter the final and most profound frontier of the position, the mental game.
Yeah.
The sources explicitly state that goaltending is the most psychologically demanding position in all of team sports.
Because you are on an island. You are out there alone. If a forward makes a terrible mistake and loses the puck, a defenseman covers for them. If a goalie makes a microscopic geometric error, a bright red light flashes, a horn blares, and 18,000 people scream at you.
Every mistake is eliminated. So how does a master goaltender handle that psychological trauma in real time? Because the true test isn't making the save. The true test is the 90 seconds after you let in a terrible soft goal that trickles through your legs.
Elite goalies survive by building a strict physical reset ritual. You have to create a circuit breaker for your brain. After a goal goes in, you do not stand there staring at the ice. You execute a physical sequence. You skate a small circle to the corner. You take exactly one squirt from your water bottle. You use your skates to aggressively scrape the ice in the crease, and you tap both posts with your stick.
You do the exact same sequence in the exact same order every single time you were scored on.
Yes. It becomes a neurological trigger. By forcing your body into a repetitive practice routine, you signal to your brain that the previous shift is officially over, the emotional trauma is boxed away, and the new reality begins right now.
And the manual is explicit about what you must not do during those 90 seconds. Do not do the tactical analysis during the game.
Never. If you stand in the crease asking yourself, should I have challenged more? Was my paddle too long? Did I drop my shoulder in the RVH? You are burning up cognitive bandwidth. You need 100% of your brain's processing power to track the next puck. Short memory on the ice, long memory in the film room tomorrow.
Mitch Korn also outlines what he calls defense mechanisms.
Yep.
This is a psychological checklist of what happens when a goalie's confidence breaks. And it is incredibly revealing.
It's a diagnostic tool for coaches. If a goalie lets in a bad goal and they immediately look down and start inspecting the blade of their stick or adjusting the straps on their arm pads, they are blaming the equipment. Their confidence is cracked. If they stand up and start screaming at their defenseman for allowing the shot, they are blaming the team. Their confidence is cracked.
And what are the physical symptoms of cracked confidence? How does it affect their geometry?
It manifests as positioning rift. A goaltender lacking confidence will subconsciously do one of two things. They will either hide deep inside the net, retreating far too much, trying to let the physical post protect them, thereby exposing too much net, or they will overcompensate and charge wildly out at shooters, completely losing their spatial awareness of the net behind them.
They abandon the math. They start guessing and flopping.
Guessing and flopping, which brings us all the way back to the very beginning of our dive. The butterfly is a tool, not a panic button. Goaltending is geometry, not reflexes.
Which brings us to the synthesis of this entire masterclass. We've spent this hour deconstructing a position that most people view as pure chaos and magic, and we've revealed the rigid math beneath it. If we distill this down to a coherent mental framework, how should we conceptualize the elite goaltender?
You should conceptualize the goaltender as a manager of geometry and a manipulator of space. They utilize highly engineered biomechanics, the perfectly anchored RVH, the shallow Y arc, the coiled stance, to systematically eliminate mathematical angles. They rely on precise, standardized communication time, man on, to direct their teammates and manage the flow of bodies in front of them. And they operate within a microscopic, heavily policed legal framework, from the paint of the crease to the exact inch of their paddle, to maintain order.
It is an incredibly intellectual position disguised as a purely physical one. Every save is the result of a depth calculation, a visual tracking protocol, and a deliberate structural choice.
And that leads to a fascinating reality about the future of the sport. We've discussed how physical rules, like the trapezoid or the maximum pad width, are constantly tweaked by leagues to artificially alter the goalie's geometry.
Right, because if goalies get too mathematically perfect, scoring drops, and the league worries about entertainment value. Which leaves us with a provocative final thought. As the skaters get faster, as the composite sticks get whippier, as the physics of the shot become increasingly lethal, will the rulemakers eventually have to step in and shrink goalie equipment even further? Will they have to mandate smaller pads to physically force holes into the geometry?
Or will the goaltender position just continue to evolve internally? Will the next generation of goalies rely even less on the hardware of massive foam pads and entirely on the software pure elite cognitive anticipation, visual processing, and flawless spatial mapping? It is the ultimate evolutionary arms race between the physics of the shooter and the geometry of the crease.
Think back to our gunslinger from the beginning. The guy who draws his weapon the fastest might win the movie, but the goaltender. The goaltender is the one who calculated the wind speed, measured the exact distance, and stood exactly where the bullet physically couldn't reach them long before the gun was even drawn. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the blue paint. Take this framework, look for the angles, look for the anchors, and apply it the next time you watch a game. We will see you on the next deep dive.